This is a Media Lab podcast. Welcome to Putting It Together, the podcast that goes through the entire body of work of Stephen Sondheim, show by show and song by song. My name is Kyle Marshall, your self-described Sondheim expert. Well, welcome back from intermission. I really hope you enjoyed my conversation with David Moeschler last week. I think he is this really fascinating guy. And as I kind of said in the intro to last week's episode, I really enjoy talking with composers and, you know, and people that actually know what they're talking about when it comes to music. This week is the return of Isaac Bernier Doyle, who has been on here a few times before, although not for a while, way longer than I meant it to be, but we have this really great conversation about The Right Girl, and I'm going to pose it right here at the very beginning of the episode. Me and Isaac ultimately, I think, have a different interpretation of who the right girl is for Buddy. So I want you to write in, whether you want to write into the email address, puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com, or if you want to hit me up over on Twitter or Instagram. I want to know who you think the right girl is. You know, as far as Sondheim news goes, the only really big thing that's going on right now is, because of how much the entertainment industry is in disarray right now, the movie studios came out this week and kind of announced what is being postponed till 2021, what is actually going to be coming out in 2020, and kind of what the release calendar is like for the next little bit. And the big news is that West Side Story, the Steven Spielberg-directed West Side Story, is supposedly still coming out in December. Now, whether that actually means in the United States, that I do not know. It is supposedly, again, I keep using that word, supposedly going to be coming out here in Canada as, you know, movies are actually being released into theaters where I live. But that is so far off that I don't even want to count those chickens. The other thing is that apparently it is going to be released onto Disney Plus a few weeks after its initial theater run. Again, that is still in very early stages, but I guess that's what's gonna happen. 2020 is just, it's a weird time, isn't it? Anyways, I'm looking forward to it. I know, A, some people don't consider West Side Story full Sondheim. However, there has been some controversy with Ansel Elgort and his behavior behind the scenes and what's gonna happen there. The set photos look beautiful to me, and I kinda wanna go and support Rita Moreno, but So I'm still semi-excited for this project, and in the back of my mind, I'm kind of trying to see if I have the time to maybe do a quick mini-series on West Side Story again. Of course, there's a full season that you can go and listen to, but I think that now that I have my feet underneath me with this whole podcasting thing, maybe I could do a return back to West Side Story and talk about it a little more. Anyways, that's just a little idea that's rattling around in my brain. I do want to thank the patrons who make this show possible. In my quest to make this show completely supported by fans, I need to thank each and every one of you who has decided to go and put money towards this project when there's so many causes and so many great things that you could be donating to that you're choosing to donate to me. I'm hugely thankful. In particular, to the God That's Good tier, I need to thank Jack, Barry, and new patron, Barry Jorgensen, I believe is how you say your last name. Thank you all so much for your continued support. Of course, you can also go and check out some of the things that are happening over on that Patreon page by going to patreon.com/puttingittogetherpodcast. But now I think it's time for Plodding Along. Plotting Along is the part of the show where I describe to you what's happening in the plot. So after the song Too Many Mornings, Sally thinks that Ben and her are actually going to get married. Ben doesn't believe this, but before he can correct Sally's thinking, she kisses him and runs off to grab her things. This is when Buddy comes out from the shadows, furious. He launches into a song where he talks about who the right girl for him is. But who is it? Like I said, I was a big fan of this chat. Also, I should point out that Isaac and me actually talked for a little extra bit about the song Country House. So that full audio is once again going to be over on the Patreon page as a little bit of extra audio that certain members get each week. I'm going to go thank some sponsors, and then when I return, it'll be my conversation with Isaac Bernier Doyle. Putting It Together is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, locally grown, community supported. The Alberta Podcast Network promotes and supports Alberta-made podcasts and connects their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. This episode of Putting It Together is brought to you by World on Fire, a new podcast from CBC Edmonton. World on Fire is a new five-part series that takes you to the front lines of out-of-control wildfires in Canada, Australia, and California. Recorded during the COVID-19 pandemic, hosts Adrian Lamb and Mike Flanagan look at what it takes to find hope in the midst of fear and destruction and how communities affected by wildfires rebuild. The series examines the high costs the wildfires cause to people's health, homes, and communities. Find World on Fire on the CBC Listen app or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find it online at cbc.ca/worldonfire. This episode of Putting It Together is also brought to you by Park Power, a provider of electricity and natural gas in Alberta that offers low rates, awesome service, and profit sharing with local charities. If you switch retailers, nothing changes about the delivery of electricity or natural gas to your home or business. If you have an existing contract, you're going to want to find out the terms for leaving. If you don't, then it's even easier to sign up for Park Power. The choice is yours, and there's a better deal available to you. Learn more at parkpower.ca.
The right girl, yeah, the right girl, she makes you...
Isaac, thank you so much for coming back.
No problem. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me once again.
Yeah, you know, you've been here before, so I want to jump like right into the meat of this conversation. I want to know when you first came across Follies.
That is a good question and one that I should have prepared with more factual information, but I feel like in my heart, it was probably maybe the third Sondheim show that I got properly into. My order, like most people's, well, I say that in my experience, most people heard Sweeney Todd first because it's got the most kind of cultural reach with the film. I think that's like not very controversial. But then I got after that super into The Woods, also because there was a film coming out.
Right.
And then after that, the reason I got into Follies was because I was becoming obsessed with Mandy Patinkin, which I think is an important stage in anyone's development, like as into adulthood.
It's puberty, Mandy Patinkin, adulthood. That's basically your life.
So. And the Mandy, like importantly, it's not a phase you finish. It's one that kind of spills out over into both other aspects of life. Because I'm still very much in that phase. But yeah, he was in like a concert version of Follies, I think.
He was.
Is his relationship. And so his version of a bunch of the songs that's on his album, Mandy Sings Sondheim, I would just listen to on repeat forever and ever. And I got to know it kind of through there. Then it came to London in, I want to say, 2017, 2018, something
that
like
was, that. Well, that was the national, that was the National Theatre version, was 2017.
Yeah. So that was that's the only time I've seen it on stage myself. But I went to see it like three times, I think, with the original cast. And then another two times after that, including the last night of the whole show Sondheim was in attendance. That was pretty hype, let me tell you.
Not to brag or anything.
Not to brag, but I also went to see Company with Sondheim in attendance on the last night as well. That wasn't the last night, but it was, you know, it's crazy stuff we had back in the day when London had a theatre industry.
Back in the before times, yes. So tell me about that. What is it about Follies that drew you in and that you continue to love?
I think the sound world of it is so unique to Sondheim's other work. Like, Into the Woods and Sweeney, the first two that I got really into, have a very kind of unifying sound throughout, I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
Whereas Follies kind of darts around because so much of it is kind of in the pastiche style and he's playing with different genres, not, you know, like wildly different, like there's no hip hop break, but within the various aspects of songs that could reasonably be performed in a Follies setting, I think he like, it's almost showboating, right? The amount that he chucks in wildly different stuff, like the opera number, the One More Kiss thing, to this, to the one we're talking about today, the kind of frenzied which is like a proper like entertainer's song. And then later into the Loveland sequence, you have some that are just like pure pastiche. So yeah, I think it was the fact that it sounded so different to other Sondheim that I'd heard, almost to the point that you're like, you could play this album for someone and convince them that each song had a different composer, which I think is incredibly, incredibly rare that that's a thing you can actually do, because most people have a very fixed sound. Even someone of like Jason Robert Brown's musicality has a very clear kind of chordal harmonic kind of oeuvre, I guess. But also it's even more rare that that's a good thing about a musical, because normally if you play like the original Broadway cast and 10 songs sound like they're by 8 to 10 different people, the problem is that it's got no like unifying whole through line. Whereas in this, I think it's the lack of that through line musically that makes it so interesting and weird. It's just such a great piece.
Yeah, this is why I think that there is so much division, especially when it first premiered on Broadway, where it got some pretty negative reviews by the critics.
Dreadful.
Yeah, pretty dreadful reviews.
History will look unkindly.
No, it's true. I mean, but I think what the, for lack of a better word, the insidious thing about this, what I've been discovering as I've been doing this season and recording episodes out of order, is that even those pastiche songs, which, by the way, can I just say, the fact that he even went so far as not just to try his hand at, you know, replicating a Cole Porter song or an Irving Berlin song, but was like, I'm going to use the musical stylings of this composer, but with the lyrics of this composer.
It's like, it's okay. It's a bit of a flex.
It's like, come on. But even those pastiche songs are commenting on what's going on in the show without being overtly commenting about what's going on in the show. And I think that's the real magic trick about Follies, is that these feel like songs that you could take out and perform, and a lot of people do, but they are also very integral to the plot of the show, such as it is, this rather plotless show after like the first 40 minutes. But I think that that's an interesting
way. It's a
real
rarity as well.
Oh, yeah.
Just in like... most people, if they're doing a show that is pastiche or like a song cycle that's kind of winking at an audience that understands that it's borrowing from forms we all know about, they will do that instead of providing a kind of emotionally satisfying arc through the piece. Like it's an incredible balancing act to pull off almost parodying styles alongside also like adding to them. And that's why it's like, it's just the most kind of respectful homage to genres that he clearly loves to the point of being able to add to them. Like, for example, Losing My Mind is the torch song. Like for many people, that is the one. And it's so rare that the pastiche manages to be elevated arguably beyond what it's pastiching.
Right. I mean,
Steve Finds a Way.
that's my t-shirt, Steve Finds a Way. The cool thing, because I've been getting this like deep affection and love for Follies, which I didn't really have before. Not because I hated it or anything. It just like was one of those ones I didn't really listen to when I was getting into Sondheim. So it's always been like this curiosity. But now that I've been researching it and getting into it, like, man, there is a great stuff. But I think part of it is something that I've identified in myself over the years. That translates into film a lot as well, which is like, I have a real big love affair for things that on paper shouldn't work, but actually do work.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I think it's not even just on paper, like just the album by itself is quite a bizarre listening experience, right? It's hard, and this is true of a few sometimes, but it's hard to like listen to the songs and be like, what on earth could this show be? Like,
yeah, what is going on?
Who are these characters? There seem to be too many people doing too many songs about like wildly divergent topics. And it's just-
What do I care about raining on the roof? What is going on?
It's like, why would that song from the end of Paddington 2 have any any relevance to this overarching plot? But yeah, I think that's like the ultimate threading of the needle because it shouldn't work. And yet I think inarguably, as the National Theatre's production showed, like it still hits so hard. Like they were selling out constantly. It was impossible to get tickets to that show.
Well, we are talking about the song The Right Girl here today. This is the first Buddy solo actually in the piece. And I do want to give credit where credit's due. So Buddy is played by Gene Nelson in the original Broadway cast, by David Healy in the 1987 London version, and then Peter Forbes in the 2017 National Theater version. Now, I was just looking at this. I think Peter Forbes was even there through cast changes, was he not?
Yeah, like, yeah. He stayed there till the end. He was one of the people who stayed on, and thank God he did, because he is like a standout in that show.
So this is going to spoil the lead a little bit here, but I have a lot to say about Peter Forbes' performance, because I think it might be the most iconic performance of this role, but that's I really enjoy it. So
yeah, same.
Can you just tell me briefly before we jump into the lyrics here, I mean, you kind of just mentioned it, like how good he was, but can you maybe describe a little bit about his performance that you got to see?
He's a very unassuming man physically, and I think that's Buddy, right? Like he doesn't look like an actor. He's not all like,
you should look like a dad. That's basically
exactly. He looks like a dad, a friendly, nice dad who's having a bad time of his life. But Peter Forbes, I was not super familiar with his work other than that he was in Mamma Mia for about 800 years, I think, back in the day. But he's not one of these. And I think this kind of perhaps hints at why he played Buddy so well. He's one of these people who speaks very fondly about that experience. He's not someone who's like, I was in Mamma Mia for 10 years. It's just for the money though. It was just for the money. I was waiting for some like artistic roles, some auteur to hire me.
Right.
He's like so happy to have been in Mamma Mia. Whenever he's interviewed about it, he was like, yeah, it was great. It was really good fun. And I think, so he kind of came out of nowhere for me in terms of Sondheim. I don't know if he's done any before. I don't think he has. But his performance was like so underplayed until it was the exact like diametric opposite to that. I'm thinking of his Loveland song, which was, had him dressed in like he looked like a sort of ventriloquist dummy had come to life as one of the Dapper Dans from Disneyland. He's in this like boater, like striped hat and striped suit. And in the original, the original incarnation of the National Theatre version from 2017, because it went away and came back with some changes. Mm-hmm. They had him performing the song with like drag queens, I think, which was a slightly odd choice and didn't last, basically.
Right. Okay.
It was removed. But yeah, I've heard a few different things about that. Apparently Sondheim, one of the people said that was Sondheim's idea, but it didn't seem to land. But yeah, basically in Buddy's Blues, he's like, it could be a new actor performing this because the energy was just so, so incredibly high. And also the precision of his like choreography. If you've seen it, he does this funny, like sort of wind the bobbin up hand jive thing when he's singing Buddy's Blues. And it's just like, just the amount of time that would have taken to nail alongside hitting the notes, hitting the like meaning behind the lyrics. It's just an incredibly precise performance. You'd never, ever felt at all like there was a slither of a chance that he would flub a line or miss a cue or something. It was just commanding.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I have only watched like the recording version of it, the one that they recorded for putting into theaters. And it's a incredibly, I think people often look at like great actors as being sometimes the flashy, like you can tell that they're acting. I always look for the people who are like, I can't tell if you're acting or not. And that's what makes this so good.
Yeah, I think that's true. He just, it's like, but it's just such a naturalistic performance for a role that is increasingly madder and madder and further from naturalism. And when it's finally like, when they finally all had this like united mental breakdown, and they crack. Mm-hmm. He, coming back as that new kind of heightened version of Buddy for Buddy's Blues, which I think we get a hint of what's to come in this song, The Right Girl.
Right.
When he came back like that, it was just like, it was like Gandalf the White returning. You're like, who is this new Buddy? Where's he been hiding? It's just an incredible performance. And just, he's a very warm presence on stage. Like you feel for him a lot.
And by the way, why couldn't you just fly the eagles into Mordor? I don't get it.
Yeah, there's no good answer, is there? There's no good answer. People on Reddit, they tried to come up with one, but ultimately he dropped the ball. It was silly.
Yeah. All right. Well, here's how this starts. So he goes, The right girl, yeah, the right girl, she makes you feel like $1 million instead of what, like a rented tux. The right girl, yeah, the right girl. She's with you no matter how you feel. You're not the good guy, you're not the heel. You're not the dreamboat that sank, you're real. When you've got, yeah, the right girl, yeah, and I got...
The right girl, yeah, the right girl. She makes you feel like $1 million instead of what, like a rented tux. The right girl, yeah, the right girl. She's with you no matter how you feel. You're not the good guy, you're not the heel. You're not some dreamboat that sank your reel. When you got, yeah, the right girl, and I got.
So it ends off on a little bit of a cliffhanger there, of course. I want to start with that specifically. What do you think is left unsaid here in this first stanza?
I think when Peter Forbes played it, he did something interesting a couple of the times. Like, I think I saw it quite early and then I saw it the latest you could see it, and it changed a bit. But on occasion, they kind of played this as sort of being unable to, not necessarily unable to decide what he means when he says, and I got, and then stops his sentence, but as kind of just getting like caught up in the, we get that weird, like violent accompaniment, that bum, bum, bum thing. And he was like, I think he was literally kind of spinning around. It was sort of like he was caught in some kind of whirlwind. So I think the meaning changes throughout the song. But I think early on, I think he's just confused. Like, it's like he's, well, I mean, it is basically that he's just found out some shocking news. Mm-hmm. And I think the, and I got is like, well, what do I have? Like, what, he thought he had something quite straightforward and clear, but there's been a clearly developing suspicion that his life with Sally is not, or that she thought it was not, or that he thought it was either. And I think this is where he's like, yeah, like, God, what do I have? Like, what is left if this all falls apart?
I literally just thought of this as you were speaking. So this is not a fully formed thought, and I'd have to think about it a little bit more.
They're best ones.
But honestly, it's almost like an inversion of Bobby from Company, saying like, what do you got? Or what do you get? Sorry, what do you get? And then launching into being alive. This is kind of him being like, and what do I got? Well, yeah. This is what I have.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, I think. Whereas Bobby is kind of like cynically trying to unpack like what you even get out of marriage or out of commitment. It seems like Buddy is dealing with like the opposite situation of trying to unpack, well, what you've got left after the commitment falls apart. Like, what are the pieces? What can he, if he takes stock of his life, even claim to have ownership of? Mm-hmm. It turns out it's not a great deal. Poor Buddy.
The other thing I think that's interesting here is how the music is going underneath him, right? Like the right girl, and then it's like, bam, like with that note, and he goes, yeah, right after it. It's weird when you listen to this song, because it almost feels like he's out of time. Like he's not doing it when that the most important note gets hit, sort of thing. And it always throws me. It's like, you feel like even as a listener that he should be saying yeah on that big brassy note and stuff, but never does.
Yes. Yeah, it is sort of behind. I'm just looking at the score and it's like, yeah, it's notated as behind that beat. And that it does create, which he sometimes goes on to use incredibly well in Live, Laugh, Love, right? This idea of like, is he messing it up or is that how it's written?
Yeah.
Which makes, I knew that song would be uncomfortable to be in the audience for if people didn't know it was coming, but I can't express the panic in a polite kind of middle-class London National Theatre attending audience when Philip Quast starts to go, me, I like to love, me, and they're just like, oh God, he's flubbed it. He's messed up the lines. It was an incredibly effective moment, more than I thought. And I think we get hints of that here as well, which is, yeah, it sort of speaks to, it blurs the line between the actor kind of having a breakdown and the character having a breakdown. It's great. And I think the years as well change in meaning. They become, it sort of starts as a, for me, I think quite sardonic, like, of course I've got the right girl, but it becomes later on a much more kind of violent, like he says them with real venom later on. And I think the fact that you can get that much from the kind of line that like an editor would tend to strike from a manuscript and be like, you can probably think of something better than yeah. But no, it works perfectly. It's the ambiguity of it that I think plays so well.
Any other lines here that you want to call out?
I really like, and I think it's emblematic of something that I like more broadly of Sondheim's style, the line, instead of what, like a rented tux. I think most writers would have gone for something like, instead of just like a rented tux,
right,
which is the more kind of obvious and self-consciously lyrical choice. But Sondheim, like Shakespeare, has such an ear for like natural, conventional, spoken dialogue that instead of what, it's just such a, like an American, it, to my ear at least, an American kind of interjecting in the middle of your own sentence, Mamet style interruption, self-interruption. They just plays so well, and it just grounds this song that's kind of come out of nowhere in quite a surprising way in that kind of spoken natural reality. That is what Buddy would say. Instead of what, like a rented tux, like he's thinking through the line. It's just little touches like that, which I think elevate an already amazing lyric.
Mine are these two lines where he says, she's with you no matter how you feel. You're not the good guy. You're not the heel. You're not the dreamboat that sank. You're real. I just love how that kind of flows. There's a lot of stuff wrapped up in that. I mean, we're supposed to think that he's talking about Margie, who we're about to meet here in the song specifically, which I think really sums up how his feelings about being with Sally, right? Like, he understands. Like, he's not this big rube that doesn't know that his marriage is not the best right now.
Yeah.
He wants to feel loved. Like, that's what he's kind of setting up here. More on that later, of course, as we go through the song. But the other thing I just like, and I actually know, like, I'm sure 1,000% that Sondheim did not mean it in this way. But when he says, you're not the good guy, you're not the heel, as a somewhat closeted wrestling fan, I just like that line because that's like wrestling terminology to mean like
what
good
does
guy's
it mean?
Bad guy. Oh, a heel is the bad guy in a wrestling match.
Okay. Interesting. So, maybe he did. Maybe Sondheim is maybe up in that WWE hype. Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows what he gets up to these days?
That's his last musical. It'll be about a wrestling match. It'll be great.
That'd be powerful. Get Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Yeah, exactly.
He's been crying out. He barely remembers the lyrics to the songs in Moana. I'm sure he'd be fine with the Sondheim score.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you seen, just as a quick side note, there's an amazing YouTube video I'd encourage all of your listeners to watch, which is Dwayne Johnson and Lin-Manuel Miranda singing You're Welcome. I can't quite remember the context. It was clearly to promote Moana. But Dwayne Johnson, whose character sings that song, knows at best 5% of the lyrics. And he's just, but he's like, he's such a confident guy that he's just like sitting there, standing up with the mic being like, na, 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 you're welcome. And he makes sure to like properly hit the You're Welcomes to be like, I'm nailing that bit. Doesn't matter about the rest. It's powerful. Powerful view.
And yeah. It's like the elementary school concert where the back row has no idea what it is, but they hit the chorus because they
practiced
that.
That's when I was playing violin in primary school and I was like, I don't know how to play this instrument. I'll just lift my bow slightly off and hope that my mum's too far away to tell that my jingle bells is not contributing to the scratchy hell that everyone else is having to listen to.
Yeah. Haha, totally nailed it. Well, the music changes, of course, and then we get into this kind of dialogue that's very one-sided because we don't actually see the character Margie on stage. But Buddy goes, hey, Margie, I'm back, babe. Come help me unpack, babe. Hey, Margie. Hey, bright girl. I'm home. What's new, babe? You miss me? You smell good. Come kiss me. Hey, Margie. You want to go dancing? I'm home.
Hey, Margie. I'm back, babe. Come help me unpack, babe. Hey, Margie. Hey, bright girl. I'm home. What's new, babe? You miss me. You smell good. Come kiss me. Hey, Margie. You wanna go dancing? I'm home.
And like, not a huge, big lyrical tour de force necessarily right here, but I'm curious about what you think about this moment. Because I can't remember, even though I've recently, within the last few weeks, have watched that National Theater version. Is this the first time he has explicitly said that he's having an affair, or has he actually said that out loud on stage?
It's a good question. I can't say for sure. I think, if I remember correctly, Buddy and Ben have a conversation very early on when they're like, Buddy's like, asks Ben, he's like, you still play around? Something like
right,
that.
Right, right.
And they both, I think they both are like, oh, no, I've given that up. But with a very clear kind of subtext that, no, they're both still messing around. So but it could be made more explicit than that. I can't quite remember. I think this bit is so nice. And I almost like, on occasion, if I'm putting this song on and like just living my life, I almost want a supercut where it's just these like B section moments, because it's so beautiful. Like,
yeah,
it's so beautifully sung. And I think Mandy and Peter nail the vocal transition from this like huge, very brash. It almost sounds like the person at a fairground who like roll up, that kind of vibe of the beginning, like the loudness of it and the brashness of it, down to this very gentle, like tender, close to the mic feel of this melody that's just so gently lilting compared to what we just had. I think there's a key change. So it like modulates without you even really noticing. And that repeated like bum, ba, bum, is just such a nice, like gentle accompaniment to this that makes it just feel radically different. It could be from a different song. I really, really like these moments.
Yeah, I do too. And I think I was going to say the word tender as well. It almost feels like it's one of those moments like, should I be here in the same room while you're sharing this moment
with me?
It's
very intimate,
It's super intimate, right? And this is going to feel like I'm like super way more negative than I am. But just because I'm such a big fan of how Peter Forbes performs this song, especially on the album when you listen to it, because it's great. It's one of the few times where I think it is better than the original Broadway cast, which no shade to Gene Nelson. I don't know if you know who Gene Nelson is, the original Buddy.
I don't know him at all outside of the context of Buddy.
So he was like well-renowned as a dancer. Like he is, he was influenced by Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire. He was in a bunch of films showing off his dancing. If you've ever seen the movie version of Oklahoma, he's Will in that.
Oh, yeah.
And then
that's cool.
The original Buddy and stuff like that. So in this song, of course, there is actually right before this smaller, more tender section happens, there's a bit of a dance break. Mm-hmm. And by all accounts, apparently, he did like this amazing dance routine before going into this tender bit. So I think that he was definitely cast, especially for his dance skills. He's a good singer too. It's just like that feeling behind the words, man, does Peter Forbes like nail every single syllable.
Yeah. And also I feel like if Buddy's a really good dancer, that really kind of dislodges something about his character. I think like Buddy is an everyman. Like even the name Buddy, he's just like, just your pal. He's just some guy. He's not like your pal who happens to be some kind of like tech genius.
Right.
He's just Buddy. Like Peter Forbes does this. He's wearing, as I recall, a kind of ill-fitting sort of talking head style jacket at this stage to the party. It's like not the best suit, not the best cut for him. Peter himself is quite a like physically unassuming guy. And he does this very like very sincere, but not very good dancing with himself box step sort of thing. And I thought that just worked so well. Like it's kind of naff, but then so's Buddy. And that's what's so nice about him.
Yeah, it's like he is literally the opposite of the famous Benjamin Stone, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. Like he's very much the foil.
Yeah.
Because you're Benjamin Stone, he could probably whip out some kind of breakdancing moment. You'd expect he'd probably have some like popping and locking up his sleeve, whereas Buddy never took the time to learn the High School Musical dance routines.
Anything that you wanted to pull from these two stanzas of this section?
I think it's interesting. Margie exists as a kind of Curly's wife figure.
Yeah,
In the sense that her identity is only revealed through other people's relationships to her. Like what she's about, who she is unclear. I think we get some hints as to the quality of their relationship later on. But the fact that it's like him, he's the driving force here. I think that kind of tells you all you need to know about the relative emotional investment. She is his midlife crisis. He's not her like future, is my impression.
Oh, gotcha.
I think like, you having to ask, you miss me, it's okay. On its own, that would be no red flag, right? You miss me, that's kind of a normal thing to say. But in the context of having to say, I'm home, what's new, you miss me, come kiss me, you want to go dancing, I'm home again. Like, it's a kind of doth protest too much sort of vibe I get from it. Whereas like, he's having to put a lot of the work in here, as you would expect, because we get the impression that Margie's a lot younger. She's lives elsewhere, even though later on we get stuff about her crying. I don't know. It just, to me, it feels like it's kind of a one-sided thing to some extent.
I have more to say about that, but I want to read these lyrics first so I have backup.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea.
So he continues on by saying, Des Moines was rotten and the deal fell through. I pushed, babe. I'm bushed, babe. I needed you to tell my troubles to. The heck, babe. Let's neck, babe. Hey, Margie, you want to go dancing? You want to go driving or something? Okay, babe. Whatever you say, babe. You want to stay home? You want to stay home?
Des Moines was rotten and the deal fell through. I pushed, babe. I'm bushed, babe. I needed you to tell my troubles to. The heck, babe, let's neck, babe. Hey, Margie, you want to go dancing? You want to go driving or something? Okay, babe, whatever you say, babe. You want to stay home? You want to stay home?
I do want to point out the fact that there is a lyric change in the London version. So after he says Des Moines was rotten and the deal fell through, in the London version, it says, she sees your problems and helps you through. She asks you things like what to do. You still have things to look forward to. So it's not really a conversation. It's almost like he's remembering back to a conversation in the London version. The syntax is a little bit weird there, in my opinion, but that's what they change it to.
I've also heard Des Moines was crazy, but I closed the deal as well in another version. I don't know if that's
Oh my gosh. Yeah, sorry. Let me rephrase that because I was reading the wrong line. Yeah, Des Moines was crazy and I closed the deal. I didn't realize how old I'd feel. That's what he says.
Des Moines was crazy, but I closed the deal. I pushed, babe. I'm pushed, babe. I didn't realize how old I'd feel. The heck, babe. Let's neck, babe.
Anything that you notice about these lines?
Expanding on what I just said, the rhetorical questions, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they're just adding and adding up. There's also, like, a kind of juvenile quality to their relationship, I think. Like, the word neck, I don't know. It sounds like teens, right?
Well, but I also, I kind of mentioned this to you before we started recording. If there was ever a tell about how this was written in the 1970s, it's that line right there. Because no one would ever say that nowadays.
Yes, that's true. But even in the 70s, like, I don't know, my impression from like films of the like 70s and 80s would be that you don't get like grown men being like, let's neck, babe.
Yeah.
It sounds like kind of like jock sort of thing to say. And I think that's part of the like fantasy of Margie, right? She represents the less complicated version of love or of something approaching love. Mm-hmm. The relationship that's just like, it's just fun and it just happens. It is easy where they can just like go for a drive and go dancing without any of the like baggage of actually having to work in a relationship, which Buddy is somewhat averse to.
Also call out about, again, no shade to Gene Nelson, but he says Des Moines wrong, which is weird. He really emphasizes the S. Des Moines is how
I wonder
he
if that's
says
a character
it.
Choice. Do you think he it thinks Buddy doesn't know how to speak? He thinks Buddy just deeply has no knowledge of the interior United States.
See, I just don't know if that would be a regional thing or not, but I know that there is a stereotype in certain areas of the United States where they like to put S's, like use guys instead of you guys and stuff like that. Okay. So I don't know if that was like an idea that they're throwing around. That's the
Bugsy Malone style.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Around the Chicago area-ish, like there's a lot of S's thrown at the end of words that don't really need to have S's thrown at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could be. Or maybe he just didn't know how to say Des Moines and no one pulled him up on it. Although it doesn't sound like the kind of thing that Sondheim would sign off on.
Right, no, I kind of agree. I think it's actually just a flub on the CD or on the recording.
Yeah.
Here's where I'm conflicted about the whole Margie character in general. Mm-hmm. Because I hear what you're saying about how this is maybe a little bit more one-sided, where it's Buddy coming and really forcing the relationship. So I guess it just depends on how truthful he's being. Because at the beginning, he mentions about how she makes you feel like a million bucks, right? Like, so he's talking about Margie, she makes him feel good. And apparently she's with you no matter how you feel. You're not the good guy, not the dreamboat that sank, right? You're not trying to achieve these expectations that Sally has of him over all of these like decades that they've been together. At the same time, like there is this undercurrent of like, oh, she doesn't really want to go out. And so I'm wondering what the reason behind that is. And I don't know if it is actually fully resolved, where it's like, is her reticence of going out because she really just wants to spend time with him, or is she embarrassed to bring him out, right?
Yes. That's a really good point. Right. I think...
Is he too old for her to bring out on a date?
It's really sad. It's a really horrible idea to think that Margie doesn't want to be seen out at like some dance hall with Buddy pulling his non-exemplar moves. right. But yeah, I think that's... I buy that interpretation for sure. And I think the repetition of you want to stay home, along with the melody of it, which kind of rises, you want to stay home, you want to stay home, it's higher the second time. It sounds like he's sort of placating her, like she's kicked off. She's like, no, you know, I don't want to go driving. I don't want to go dancing. When you're here, we hang out at home. That's the vibe.
Yeah.
It sounds like, yeah. No. You want to stay home. I get it. You want to stay home. That's how I interpret it, which is, definitely a kind of sadder interpretation of your two options. But I think it's a sad song. I think Buddy's a sad guy.
I mean, no matter how you cut this is tragic, especially when we get to the very, very end. I suppose if you wanted to be the optimist in this, it's like, no, she really loves him, but she just wants to spend time with just him. Unfortunately, there's a lot of other baggage that we have to get through here at the same time. So there's a little bit of another break again. This is usually a dance break again. A little bit of choreography goes along. And then he continues on saying, hey, Margie. It's day, babe. My flight goes. No, stay, babe. You know how you cry, babe. Stay home. Be good now. We'll speak, babe. It might be next week, babe. Hey, Margie. Goodbye, babe. I gotta go home.
Hey, Margie. It's day, babe. My flight goes. No, stay, babe. You know how you cry, babe. Stay home. Be good now, we'll speak, babe. It might be next week, babe. Hey, Margie, goodbye, babe. I gotta go home.
So I guess that's the thing. Like, he doesn't want to bring her to the airport because maybe she's going to cry because he's going to leave. Or is there a different way to read that?
I see it as quite like the inverse of Barcelona from Company, where the joke is that she couldn't care. Well, I'm saying she because the most recent one I've seen is female Bobby, which is now my favorite version as well.
Right.
Bobby doesn't really care about this guy going. She's just like, yeah, off you pop. We've had our night. Off you go to Barcelona, mate. Like, we're good. Here, I see it as like he's kind of baiting her to ask him to stay, sort of thing, where he's like, well, yeah, I've got to go now. Yep. No, I've really got to go. It's really, I'm, you know how you cry. It's like, I don't buy that she does cry personally. I think she probably is sad, but maybe not in the same way that he is. And I don't know, the fact that he has to tell her how she's going to feel, the fact that it's so one-sided and that he's kind of directing her, saying that like the flight's going, you stay. You'd cry if you were there, or you'll cry if I'm not, like either way. And then the curtain kind of slips a bit when he's like, we'll speak, but it might not be for a week. It's like, if it were the kind of relationship with the depth of feeling that you're pretending it has, Buddy, then I feel like you'd find time before next week. If she's crying at home because you've abandoned her to go back to your failing marriage, I feel like you'd make the time. You'd go out and say you were picking up milk or something, find a call box. It just, I don't know, there's something, it's more than needs to be the case. It's like when, you know, if like a kid is lying and they're like, no, I didn't take the sweets, and they come up with some like mad story about why they didn't. It's like, well, no, I was sat at the other side of the room and I was looking out the window and I saw a pigeon, so I couldn't have taken them at that time. You're like, okay, well, you've over explained, you've overplayed your hand, I think. It has that kind of vibe where he's like, if it were of the quality of emotional sincerity and depth that he wants to pretend it is, you wouldn't have to say this stuff. And Sondheim wouldn't put it in.
Right.
Because it would work unsaid. The melody is beautiful enough, and the tenderness, the kind of vocal quality that Mandy Patinkin does so well with that like excess vibrato that he has just to a T. That says it all. You don't need to say stuff like, you're going to cry and be good and we'll speak soon. Like, it would be enough just to say goodbye and know it.
I mean, yeah, I think that the biggest tell in that is that he says it might be next week, right? It's not like you could very easily rewrite that line to be, I'll see you next week, babe. Like, yeah, this is not a definitive thing. It's not definite that he's going to even be there. So how close his relationship really is, it seems like he only gets to see her or will only see her when he's like on his quote unquote business trip to see her and drop by sort of thing. This is how the song ends. So we go back into how the song opens, right? The right girl. Yeah, the right girl. She sees you're nothing and thinks you're king. She knows you got other songs to sing. You still could be hell, well, anything when you got, yeah, the right girl. And I got, and then we get into, again, that tender section. Hey, Margie, I'm back, babe. Come help me unpack, babe. Hey, Margie. Hey, bright girl. I'm home. You miss me? I knew it. Hey, Margie, I blew it. I don't love the right girl. Aw, shit.
You're king. She knows you got other songs to sing. You still could be hell, well, anything when you got, yeah, the right girl. Yeah, and I got. Hey, Margie, I'm back, babe. Come help me unpack, babe. Hey, Margie, hey, bright girl, I'm home. You miss me, I knew it. Hey, Margie, I blew it. I don't love the right girl. Oh, shit.
One end.
What an end. Now, a few things to unpack here. Number one, even in the book Finishing the Hat, Sondheim says that he says, aw, hell, at the end, except that only happens in the 1987 London version. Every other version has the aw shit in it. Even the original Broadway cast does. The second thing is that that very last bit that I just read out does not appear in Finishing the Hat, and yet is in every single recording I've ever listened to. So I don't. Yeah. I think there's a printing error in this book of how it does not include that very last section. The Hey Margie, I'm back, babe. That whole section is not written out.
It can't really function unless maybe originally they had more dialogue there or something.
Perfect, like, perhaps.
I don't know. Maybe he has some dialogue to her, even if she's not on stage. But yeah, like thematically, the song cannot have ended there. So
yeah,
I think printing error is a good shout.
Yeah. Now here's what I have to say. Like, until this conversation, I actually had a different interpretation of this song. So you're slowly changing my mind a little bit, because initially what I thought was so tragic about this song was that, yes, he is protesting too much. I mean, but I kind of interpreted it originally as Margie like really loves him, but he still really loves Sally. And the tragedy here is that Sally doesn't love him back, and he can't love Margie back in the same way. So he's in between these two weird things where the different ends of the relationship, where like in a relationship where the other person is not as interested in you as you are, but from two different angles. Right. So when he gets to the end here and says, I blew it, I don't love the right girl, oh shit, because I actually love Sally, but she doesn't love me back. But you definitely could read it in the same way of like, I don't love the right girl, oh shit, I'm still with my wife and I should be with this other person. Right. So I don't know how you look at this.
I interpret it as being kind of neither of those, in the sense that I think the reason he never says who the right girl is that he doesn't know. Like, all he knows is that something's not working.
Yeah.
It's like that thing of like, you don't have to be a firefighter to point out when the house is on fire. Like, he doesn't know what exactly the solution to this problem is. He just knows that it's killing him to exist in this sort of in-between hinterland between like a girl who, I absolutely buy that Margie is into him on some level. I would disagree perhaps that she's in love with him. I just, right. I don't see it. I don't see it in the text. I also just, like, practically speaking, like, how many times are they seeing each other? Like, how often sure. can he sneak away for business and stuff? I'm sure she feels something for him. Like, definitely she does. But love, I don't know. Being stuck between that feeling, it's like grass is greener sort of vibe of what Margie represents, or what she represents at least in his head, compared to the stasis and the kind of crumbling of that relationship with Sally. I think all he knows is that he doesn't love, yeah, the right girl. Like, either way, his love is misplaced.
Yeah, because you can tell that he's on the verge of a breakdown of some sort, because Peter Forbes, as well as David Healy, I have to say, from the 1987 London version, to a degree, like, they're almost crying through that last bit. It's like,
it's horrible.
Like, it's heart-wrenching, because it's like, oh, you're about to lose it here. Yeah. Sort of
I think it's really cool bit of writing melodically as well, because we've had this structure, like, Sondheim loves, like, he has a kind of Reichian love for just repeating figures, right? So this da 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 bum bum bum, and the same with this, just the melody of the "Hey Margie, I'm back, babe." Like, we've heard all this before, but what we haven't heard is that melody accompanied by a seismic shift in what he's actually saying. So far he's just been like babbling on about broadly the same stuff. "Hey Margie, I'm back, help me unpack," all this stuff. But now he's like, "You miss me? I knew it." And we expect her to be something like positive that follows, but then all of a sudden we get, "Hey Margie, by the way, just want to throw this out there, I've ruined my entire life, just deal with that now." And it just, it kind of catches you, and Peter Forbes played it particularly well, yeah, because it's just, it is this moment of like sudden realization. Is it triggered by her saying that she missed him, or is it triggered by her not saying that she missed him and him having to say it? Either way, I think the moment catches you quite off guard, because we've been lulled into this sense of like melodic security with this repeating kind of soft structure that's sung so delicately by everyone who's played it, I think. And then suddenly you just get this, like, what a thing to say to Margie, just out of nowhere. Like, he's just walked in. "Come help me unpack, by the way. My life is a farce. Like, I've ruined.
My life is over.
This is it.
Want to stay home tonight? It's going to be great."
"Yeah, I'm not feeling the dancing tonight, Margie. You've got to say, it'd be hard to whip out the waltz in this particular emotional stupor." Yeah, it's so cool. Such a cool end.
Mm. I guess overall, like, is this a like one of your favorite songs from Follies? Like, where does it fall?
I'd say it's probably, I love all of Buddy's stuff in Follies a lot. I love his part in Waiting for the Girls Upstairs. I think I like a lot of the songs for different reasons. Like, I think Waiting for the Girls Upstairs is one of the most like technically accomplished song. Like, it's just a mad song to have developed. It's one of those puzzles that you look at and you're like, well, how do you even start? Like, like the prologue for Into the Woods. Like, what, where do you start writing that? I think Waiting for the Girls Upstairs has bordering on that level of complexity. But in terms of like the solo numbers, it's possibly my favorite of the solos. Yeah, I think that could be the case. I really love most of the songs in it, so it's not by like a wild margin, but it would either be The Right Girl or The Road You Didn't Take, probably would be vying for the top spot. And it's just both because they're like, they're just intensely sad. Yeah. And I think you've got to lean into that with Follies, because it is just heartbreaking stuff.
Yeah, this is it's not for the faint of heart. Like, this is I was joking with another person I was recording with here the other day, but it's like, I knew the basic structure of Follies, but I don't think I really knew how everyone ended up necessarily. And so I like popped this on like on a Tuesday night. I'm like, oh, I was not emotionally ready for this for this production, but here we are.
I know the feeling.
Do you have a sense of who the right girl is at all, or is it like an unnamed person that we haven't met?
I would probably want to argue that she doesn't exist, and that no one is the right girl. No one is the right guy. No one is the right anything. And it's like the thesis of Follies, at least in some level, is that relationships are like only, they're a product of work, right? They don't just happen incidentally to your effort at maintaining them. And the problem with all four characters is that they've been neglecting each other in radically different and interesting ways. And I think Buddy's problem is, and something that I meant to bring up earlier, is that his like self-esteem is awful. It gets progressively worse through this song as well. Like, it's fine to say you're not the dreamboat, but to say that she sees you're nothing, like, mate, get real. You're a good guy, buddy. You've got a lot to offer. You've got to be kinder to yourself than this. His self-esteem is so low that I think he can't offer. Like, it's that classic thing of, how can you love someone else until you love yourself properly first?
Yeah.
And I think, although corny, there's an element of truth there. Like, for Buddy, the right girl could be Margie right now, but give it a few years and the same kind of thing is going to happen, because how do you deal with someone who's like kind of this needy, but unwilling to share their neediness? Like, he needs so much validation, and in fact provides most of the validation to himself throughout the show, because no one else is giving him any of it, unfortunately. Well,
yeah. It's like how there's an offhanded comment in the song that was only in the 87 version, right, of Country House, which is where Phyllis kind of says, oh, you should go and see a shrink. And I feel like that about like every character in this piece. Yeah, like, maybe you should
it's
just
the truest, truest words spoken.
Talk about this with somebody.
Yeah.
And that would help out.
Very true.
Isaac, thank you so much for coming back onto the show. If people wanted to see what you're up to online, how could they do so?
Good question. It's most stuff is either at IsaacBD on Twitter, Instagram, all the normal stuff. I have a podcast which is kind of on quarantine hiatus, on the basis that I realized that I personally have not listened to a podcast in about a month, because they're so tied into like the physical action of getting on the tube and like going to work and doing stuff that it's weird to find the time. But I have a show called That's a Shame, which is at That's a Shame Cast. We just talk about like stuff. Yeah, it's not a great pitch, but you either like it or not. Also, if I can quickly plug the subreddit, which I run, rsondheim, reddit.com/r/sondheim or sondheim.reddit.com. We're one of the biggest discussion places for Sondheim now. How did that happen while I was looking away?
It's great.
And compared to, I'm in like a bunch of these, right? There's the big Facebook group called, what's it called?
Finishing the chat. Yeah.
Which is great and it has its place. But God in heaven, there are some strong-minded people who are not afraid to really shout each other down in the most kind of aggressive and often pseudo-intellectual way over at Finishing the Chat, which is, you know, otherwise a great place. We don't have that on our Sondheim. We're mostly memes and chat. So head over there for some of that.
Yeah. Stay away from Facebook. It's a silly place.
Yeah, it's just not the one. It's a great place if you want to talk about 5G and how it's definitely not playing a role in coronavirus.
Once again, thank you so much, Isaac.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. You can send emails to puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. Also, you can follow Sondheim Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. And you can support the show on Patreon by going to patreon.com/puttingittogetherpodcast. Thanks to the Alberta Podcast Network, to Park Power, and to World on Fire this week. Putting It Together is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts from. Consider subscribing so that you never miss an episode. Next week, we're going to be talking about One More Kiss. I have to train my opera voice to get ready. As always, a big thanks to the great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and to Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. Well, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now.
The way that Diana Rigg sings, Maybe We Could Take a Suite at the Waldorf, is the greatest delivery of a line in any medium.